Welcome back to Dan's Dabble and Babble. I really have to hand it to my producer because I am constantly overwhelmed at the quality of guests that we get on this program. We seem to outdo ourselves each week. We've gone from owner of a book publishing house, professional wrestler, Olympic gymnast, and this week we have an esteemed Bitcoin expert. And before we jump in on what this week is going to be about, I really want to call your attention to a couple of ways that you can engage with us if you're enjoying the program. So first, we have established a Twitter for the show. So if you are so inclined, give us a follow. The handle is @babblingdan. Listen, I don't know if any of you are illiterate or not, so let me spell it out for you. It's @BABBLINGDAN. And if you want to connect with us and send us a message, you can do that at anchor.fm/dansdabbleandbabble. And there's a hyphen in between each of those words. So it's anchor.fm/dans-dabble-in-babble. That just rolls right off the tongue. You can leave us a message there. Any message you leave will play on the next show. You can also, if you're so inclined and liking what you're hearing, keep us going by dropping a few bucks in the support link. So Dennis, thank you so much for wrangling these guests. And I think wrangling is definitely an apt word to use for our guest this week, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I don't think he'd be going out on a limb to call our next guest the Bitcoin cowboy.
My one regret, this is a fascinating interview. My one regret, I just have to compliment Jimmy. So I really hope he goes back and listens to this so he can hear me compliment. He was wearing a fantastic cowboy hat, and the man's got style and he's got knowledge. So this is a great week. And you were listening to the interview. Did you learn a lot? You knew a lot more about Bitcoin. I've been very resistant to Bitcoin because I don't understand it, and things that I don't understand scare me.
Mr. Song confirmed a lot of what I knew about Bitcoin, but phrased it way more eloquently than I could ever do. And I think anyone that's skeptical to Bitcoin and the whole concept of cryptocurrencies will want to listen to this because he sheds a lot of light on those issues that you don't know what you're questioning something about Bitcoin, but you don't know how to phrase it. He probably answers it for you in this conversation.
Absolutely. And I mean, a lot of my exposure to Bitcoin has been from Dennis giving me his pitch. And I say, yeah, that's nice. But I'm teetering. This is the most I've ever concerned looking into how to actually acquire a Bitcoin. So it really is a fascinating interview. So I'm so glad to have had this conversation. So without further ado, here is our interview with Jimmy Song. Welcome back, folks. Thank you for joining us for another exciting week here at Dan's Dabble and Babble. Our next guest promises to enlighten us and teach us a lot about a hot topic, Bitcoin. So with us this week is Jimmy Song, who is a Bitcoin developer, educator, and entrepreneur. He's an open source contributor to many different Bitcoin projects and is the author of Programming Bitcoin, The Little Bitcoin Book, and Thank God for Bitcoin. Jimmy writes a weekly newsletter, Bitcoin Tech Talk, and has a podcast, Bitcoin Fixes This. So Jimmy, thanks so much for being here this week. I think it's fair to say you're pretty into this whole Bitcoin thing.
Yeah, I would say so. That would be one way of putting it. I've been involved for, I guess, about 10 years now. So it's been a significant chunk of my life. But yeah, I've been paying attention to it in pretty much every aspect for a long time now. And it's great to see, of course, a bull market. But yeah, I think there's significance far beyond that, which I hope that we can talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm so excited to talk to you because Bitcoin, one, terrifies me. And that's because I have been a bit obstinate in refusing to really learn that much about it, to be quite frank. And even you saying you've been dealing with this for 10 years, that just goes to show how little I know that it's been around that long. Because of course, it's had such an explosion of attention, at least over the past couple of years. So I guess my opening question is kind of, what is your elevator pitch? What is Bitcoin? Why do we need it?
Yeah, and that's a much deeper question than you might think, because it really gets to the heart of what is money. And for a lot of people, Bitcoin doesn't really make sense until they understand money, because it's solving a problem they don't really understand exists. So let me quickly try to summarize what is wrong with today's money. Today's money is what we call fiat currency, central bank backed fiat currency. It used to be that the dollar was backed by gold, but that ended in 1971, pretty much unilaterally by Richard Nixon when he cut the convertibility to gold. But you know, it used to be that you can hand in $20.67 and get 1 ounce of gold from any bank in the United States. That ended with Executive Order 6102 by Franklin Delano Roosevelt back in 1933. So really, things have changed quite a bit. And the system as it currently stands is more or less controlled by central banks. And this is how every currency in the modern world works, is they get to create money through issuance of debt. And this has all sorts of very bad consequences, including a lot of the societal ills that we see today. So, you know, to try to give you an elevator pitch of what Bitcoin is, it's that Bitcoin fixes a lot of the problems that we see with fiat money, which is nepotism, a lot of political cronyism, you know, people that get rich off of, you know, essentially stealing off of everybody else, you know, the crazy monetary things that are going on, the fluctuations of the economy, and all of that stuff is largely caused by the monetary system that we have. So going towards Bitcoin solves a lot of these problems, and many more actually, but you know, which we can get into. But that's why Bitcoin, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, great. I think that's a great jumping off point. And it just kind of, for me, I love that you brought up the fiat currency issue, because that's such a huge problem. And I know, kind of following some hardcore libertarian politicians, there used to be people screaming that we needed to go back to the gold standard. And now I'm seeing kind of that trend of you're hearing less and less about the gold standard and hearing more and more about the cryptocurrencies, especially Bitcoin. So I guess my big question then of, back before the executive order you mentioned, are money related to a physical asset, the physical asset of gold? We can kind of understand it's this rare precious metal, can kind of understand the scarcity of it and where value from that is derived. And I think it's a really salient and important point that when you start looking into the power that, at least in the United States, the Fed has in controlling inflation, deflation, and how little oversight is related to the Fed. Those are big important issues, but to me, where I always come to this is, where then does Bitcoin derive its value? Because to me, and again, this is me coming at this from someone who has not really grasped what blockchain, what cryptocurrency really is. But to me, it seems like it's these zeros and ones, bits, that's stored in a computer. And why should I have more faith in the value of that than the value of something backed by world governments?
Yeah, and I totally get it. And this is something that takes some time to really get. And even for people that come into Bitcoin, oftentimes what happens is they get into Bitcoin because, you know, the number's going up or whatever, and they put a little money into it, they're excited, and then they start learning about it. And typically it takes something like 3 to 5 years before people really fully understand it. At least it did for me, and it has for a lot of other people. So don't feel bad that you don't understand it completely yet. I'm gonna try my best to explain why it is that Bitcoin is valuable and where it derives its value. But let's go back to fiat money for a second. What is the US dollar backed by? And it's actually not backed by anything, right? You can't convert it to gold. If you try to convert your dollars to gold at the Federal Reserve or any bank, they're gonna just kind of laugh at you. You can, of course, buy gold for dollars, sure. But there's no guaranteed convertibility. It's not equivalent to anything, unlike how it used to be. During sort of the Gilded Age, 1880 to 1910 or so, every currency in the world was actually convertible directly to gold. So the German mark, the English pound, whatever currency was around, you can actually go to the bank and say, okay, I would like gold for these pieces of paper, please. And they would actually give it to you. That more or less suspended starting in World War I, and by Bretton Woods in 1944, just nobody could do it except for central banks with the United States. So, it's not really backed by the current money that you use right now is not really backed by anything. People say full faith and credit of the United States, the government of the United States.
Sure, but what does that mean exactly?
Yeah, it doesn't really mean anything. It's the central bank can at any time print lots and lots of money. And we've seen this year. The Federal Reserve M2 money supply has gone at the beginning of 2020 was about 15.5 trillion. Currently, it's in the range of 19.5 trillion. So it's increased by something like 30% just in the past year. And that's because of all of the economic stimuluses and payment protection loans and checks that everyone is receiving. This is where it's getting funded from. They just kind of print it. And this is the same in every other country as well. You have the Bank of Japan doing the same in Japan, Bank of China doing the same in China, and so on. Now, what is Bitcoin backed by? Well, Bitcoin is backed by true digital scarcity. And that might seem kind of like an oxymoron to a lot of people that are listening. How can you have digital scarcity? Like there are zeros and ones, and they're probably... they probably have in their mind sort of the mental model of something like an MP3 file, right? Like you remember those file sharing services from the 90s or whatever, where you could just kind of send an MP3 to other people and it's an exact duplicate copy. How can something like that, which is infinitely copyable, be scarce? And this is the real innovation of Bitcoin, is that it actually is scarce. It's not like an MP3 file. It's actually, there's actually a ledger backing it, and this is what we call the blockchain. There's a ledger of a max of 21 million bitcoins, and whenever you transfer bitcoins, it gets recorded on that ledger. And anyone that is running the Bitcoin software has the entire copy of the ledger. So at any time, if you're running what you call a full node, you know exactly how much is in every address, and you don't necessarily know who those addresses are, but the accounting, the summing up of all of the Bitcoins that exist is always less than 21 million. And that's how you get that digital scarcity. Now there's a lot of other technical detail behind that, but digital scarcity is possible, kind of like the physical scarcity of gold. And in fact, there's a lot of sort of analogies between gold and Bitcoin in the sense that it's decentralized. I could go dig for Bitcoin in my backyard if I want to. I'm probably not going to be successful unless I happen to live over a gold mine, but I can try to do that and no one can really stop me. Same is not true of like trying to print my own dollars. If I do that, I get arrested and the Secret Service comes and gets me and I get thrown in prison or whatever. With gold, anyone can kind of go look for it. And in fact, there's lots of companies that actually try to go and mine gold. There are gold mining companies that do this all the time. With Bitcoin, you have a similar process, except it's done on computers, and it's called Bitcoin mining, and that's how new Bitcoins come into existence. And it really is scarce, and it is a very difficult activity. And just kind of like how I can go to my backyard with a shovel and try, you can technically with your phone try to look for something called proof of work, which is the equivalent of like a gold ounce or something, and actually search for it. And if you happen to find it, then you get rewarded with Bitcoin. That is a whole different process, but it is actually digitally scarce. And because it's digitally scarce, it has a lot of properties that gold doesn't. For example, I can send Bitcoin to somebody on the other side of the world in less than 10 minutes. And that's kind of amazing that you can do that at without any physical transfer taking place. Even with US dollar, if it's like the physical cash currency, it's actually quite difficult to physically move around. And there's the problem of counterfeits and things like that, which are very difficult to verify. With Bitcoin, it's very easy to verify. All you have to do is run some software and query against the ledger and make sure that you actually receive the amount that you are expecting. So in a sense, it's backed by what anything scarce is backed by, which is its own scarcity. Gold is valuable because it is very scarce. There's a stock of gold that exists in the world, and no matter how hard the gold miners try, they can't seem to produce more than 2% of the entire stock of gold in any given year, no matter what the price might be. And this has been true for most of gold's lifetime. Other commodities, this has not been true. So for example, salt used to be used as money because it was very difficult to produce until people figured out ways to produce lots of salt all at the same time. Now salt is not used as money anymore because it's relatively easy to produce. And if we used it as money, we'd get inflation very quickly and it would kind of become worthless. So the scarcity itself ends up being probably the most important property of money. And this is something that Bitcoin definitely has.
So that was a lot that you just laid on us there, and I just learned so much, and the a couple of things that really stood out to me that cleared up some misconceptions for me and have had me not totally convinced yet, I'll be honest, but mm-hmm. but more willing to realize that I should be more open-minded about this. As one, the cap of the 21 million Bitcoin was not something that I was aware of. That it makes so much sense, and the transparency and the ledger, kind of that security and knowing that that you're not just gonna, because that's one thing that I've been skeptical of, is if it's this digital currency, then who's to say that we have a certain amount of Bitcoin today, why don't we have a billion more of it tomorrow, and then just completely runs wild. So the cap makes a lot of sense, and obviously people who are much smarter than me would have been well aware of that. But you also bring up this point of in there the historical context of how often we've changed our monetary systems, because for me, and I think for a lot of people, that's where a lot of the resistance is naturally going to come from, right? Is that we've been using this system of money for obviously well past my entire lifetime, my parents' entire lifetime. So it's kind of something we take for granted. But even in my grandparents' lifetime, we had the major change divesting from the convertibility and the gold standard. And of course, we're so far removed from trading commodities like salt and kind of going to the trading post without a standardized currency and all of that. So I think that is important to keep in mind in this conversation, that this isn't necessarily the idea of changing a monetary system is not necessarily a radical idea. But one question that I do have that I think is kind of born of the Bitcoin craze is all of these cryptocurrencies apart from Bitcoin, that it's really kind of hard to wrap your head around what is legitimate. And kind of to that end too, Bitcoin is, of course, the flagship cryptocurrency. So what is it that sets Bitcoin apart from other cryptocurrencies? And what dangers are we looking at with the developments of alternative cryptocurrencies as well?
Yeah, excellent question. So just to give you a little bit of history, Bitcoin was created around 2008 by an anonymous person called Satoshi Nakamoto. And the code was actually released in 2009. People started using it in 2009. Obviously, the people that did back then are quite wealthy.
Sure.
But that was back in 2009. The first altcoins didn't really come into existence until 2011. The interesting thing is what put Bitcoin on the map was 2010, WikiLeaks stopped getting, or PayPal cut its relationship with WikiLeaks. So they this was probably one of the first major deplatformings of our time, right? Like they deplatformed WikiLeaks because the government was giving them pressure because WikiLeaks was, leaking all these things. So they got cut off and they needed some other way for people to give them donations. They found Bitcoin, and Satoshi Nakamoto at that time said that was totally against using Bitcoin for WikiLeaks because he didn't think that this nascent currency at the time, it was trading at less than a dollar, would be appropriate for this because it would just bring in too many users and so on. WikiLeaks did it anyway. By the way, they're still running off of the donations from 2010, which should tell you something.
Yeah.
Right after that, basically Satoshi Nakamoto disappeared and hasn't been heard since. Now, one of the consequences of that is that Bitcoin is decentralized, right? It's kind of like gold, like I told you before. Mm-hmm. Anyone can go mine it. The code is pretty much fixed in stone in the sense that it will always be sort of backwards compatible. There might be new features added, but it's always going to be backwards compatible. The difference between Bitcoin and every other altcoin is that Bitcoin is decentralized. That is, there's no single authority that gets to decide stuff. Every other coin has some sort of central authority, usually the creator of the cryptocurrency or a foundation or somebody in charge. So, for example,
yeah, that's such an important, it's such a fine detail that's kind of easy to overlook, but please enlighten us as to why that's such a big deal.
Yeah, it's a big deal because they're the ones that kind of control it. So Ethereum is the number two cryptocurrency, right? And this was created by Vitalik Buterin in 2014 and released to the public in 2015 and so on. But nobody actually knows the exact supply of Ethereum, and there's no hard cap. They purposefully did it that way. I think there's a fixed amount of Ethereum that comes online every year. So for all intents and purposes, there is no cap on Ethereum. There can be infinite. And if Vitalik wants, he could just change the ledger at any time and say, okay, I'm going to print 500 million Ethereum for this government that's holding my family hostage, whatever. And that's Ethereum. There's a lot of other cryptocurrencies that have the exact same problem. They have a founder, a central authority, and in fact, many of them have lots of bugs that introduce this sort of inflation, like unintentionally and so on. So that would be the big distinction for me, is that Bitcoin, because Satoshi Nakamoto left, and because it's been around so long, and because it's always backwards compatible, is decentralized, whereas all of these other ones, they're not always backwards and backwards compatible. There is a central sort of person and authority, and they do expand their money supply whenever there's quote unquote an emergency and so on. It's not decentralized; it's centralized, and it's more similar to the U.S. dollar with the Fed.
That's exactly what I was going to ask, if it would be a fair comparison to highlight the Fed as the same sort of central authority problem. So thank you for taking it there.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right.
So yeah, no, that is, and again, it really is important to kind of bring into light, because the way the Fed works is confusing even on a surface level, and there's so much that is not transparent about it. Comparing Bitcoin to these alt currencies with that central authority, I think really helps bring into light the issues that we have with the US dollar and the Fed. So another big kind of surface level, someone who knows nothing about Bitcoin, like myself, you know, my computer can get a virus. Mm-hmm. Why am I trusting the security of a digital currency, specifically Bitcoin? What is lending security to Bitcoin?
Yeah, so great question. Essentially, your computer definitely can get a virus, and if it's corrupted, then your computer might lie to you when you query it and say, "Did I receive 5 Bitcoin?" The nice thing is there's literally thousands of other people that are running the same thing, and you can query any of them and ask the same question, like, did this person actually pay me 5 Bitcoin like he said he would? And you can easily tell. And a lot of people actually already do this. Is did I actually receive it? Is my node telling me? Is their node telling me? And there's a lot of them that are online.
Let me jump in on a question here then, because that's something that you've brought up a couple of times, is this verification of being paid. So the transfer, I understand one of kind of the hallmarks of Bitcoin, as you mentioned earlier, is that you can transfer currency across the world within minutes. And that's unlike anything else that any other system that we have. But is it difficult? Because now here's a concern that I have. Is it difficult? Do I have to verify every transaction I have every time? If my employer starts paying me in Bitcoin, how difficult is it for me to actually verify and know that I've actually received the Bitcoin?
Well, I mean, that depends on the software you're using, but a lot of wallet software that's on your phone, for example, they'll check multiple different nodes to see whether or not you receive it, and it'll do it in the background and tell you it's actually confirmed or whatever. So the user experience aspect of it isn't as intimidating as the technical reality, which is you have to go query these things or whatever. And the nice thing is, because there's thousands, you can run multiple yourself if you wanted to. And I personally do, because, I'm a geek and I do this stuff for a living. But you can go query it, and you can always be certain of how many Bitcoin you have or whatever. And that is absolutely critical to making the entire system work, because all of those nodes are constantly validating every transaction, essentially, that you're not creating any new money, or that it's not being done illegitimately, and so on. So if anyone tries to cheat, then they'll just be, sort of walled off from the network and say, well, you're cheating, I'm not going to talk to you anymore. Like all the nodes are sort of constantly talking to each other and asking for any new data that might have come in. And they validate all of it. And that's the purpose of that software. And this is where it's a lot easier to trust, because it's been validated literally thousands of times. Whereas, with the US dollar, I mean, like, think about the Fed. Like, no one's really audited the Fed. Like, no one knows what's going on, or what's on their balance sheet, or how much money they printed, or how many treasuries they bought, or how much they funded the government, or how much they lent out to, mortgage-backed securities or whatever. Like, these are not questions that you ever get answered, and or even who's making the money off of the interest that they're charging whenever they lend out money. So Bitcoin is completely transparent, whereas pretty much our current financial system is completely not. It's actually purposefully opaque, so that we don't find out about all of the shenanigans that are going on in the background.
Right, and it sounds to me that I think you would argue one of the strengths is, and correct me if I'm characterizing this wrong, but because Bitcoin is divorced from any political governing body. So it's not a US currency, it's not a Japanese currency, it's just kind of this global currency. Then that really kind of lends itself as a strength, because you're not dealing with kind of the political background. Is that fair to characterize it in that way?
Yeah, I think in my latest book, we call it like everyone wants money out of politics. Really, the way to fix politics is to take the politics out of money. And that's what Bitcoin is. It's money without any of the politics. With something like the US dollar, whenever Congress runs a budget deficit, they get funded by the Fed, right? Like if they don't, they're supposed to sell treasuries, and the public and other foreign governments buy some of it. But often, like when the deficit is so high, like it was last year, like a couple $1 trillion or something like that. I mean, you don't have enough buyers. So you sell maybe 500 billion of it. The other $1.5 trillion, the Fed will just buy it, right? Like they'll print $1.5 billion and put the $1.5 trillion worth of Federal Reserve treasuries on their balance sheet, and that's how $1.5 trillion just comes into existence. And it's a lot more than $1.5 trillion, but you get my point. That's how it works.
And I think there's a kind of a natural tendency to kind of because we've just accepted the government hand in monetary systems for so long, there's that natural tendency to kind of question and be afraid of divorcing it from that. But I think you're making some excellent points as to why that's really one of the strengths. So then another thing that I'm really curious to hear your perspective on is, you know, Bitcoin has more attention now than it ever has, and the momentum is certainly growing. So where do you see us in the next few years of it being commonplace for me being able to buy a cup of coffee with Bitcoin or use it kind of more in my everyday going to the grocery store? Do you see that? Do you think we're on the cusp of that, or is there still time to go for that to be the reality? Or is that even the plan for Bitcoin?
Yeah, great question. And this has been something of a debate in the Bitcoin community, but I think it's more or less settled now. So here's what I would say. There are lots of ways to pay for coffee, and I'll just name you off some of them. You got Amex, you got Visa, you got you got PayPal, you got Venmo, you got Cash App, you got Apple Pay, Samsung Pay, and if you're international, you know about Octopus Card, M-Pesa, WeChat. There's so many ways in which you can pay, right? And there, if you have Google Wallet or whatever, you know, I mean, just literally everyone is in that space. There are umpteen ways to pay for things. And when you're asking about, oh, can I pay for coffee with Bitcoin? You can, but it's not something that you're going to want to do. And the reason is this: there are very few ways to store value. So if you work and you save money, there aren't very many ways to actually make sure that the value that your savings holds its value. And in fact, there are really only two or three other than Bitcoin that I've identified. One is stocks. And the reason why stocks are going crazy right now is because all of that newly printed money tends to go into stocks, because the people that receive this newly printed money, they don't want to sit on cash. If they do, it's kind of like a melting ice cube. You know that the Fed's going to print more money, so it's going to shrink. Another one is real estate, right? Real estate has also gone crazy over the last generation or so. And there's a reason why it keeps expanding. It's because land is scarce, right? I think it was Will Rogers or somebody that said, buy land. They're not making any more of it. The scarcity of land means that, you know, there real estate tends to also have this store value function. Any investor will tell you real estate over the long term always does kind of fantastic for that reason. But at the same time, it's kind of gotten crazy. It used to be, a house was about a year's worth of income. Now it's like more like 4 or 5 years worth of income. Sure. Similar with the S&P 500 stock. It used to, one share used to be like maybe an hour of work. Now it's like, one share of the S&P 500 was like one day of work. Now it's like 5 days of work or something like that. That tells you just kind of how inflated everything is. And both of those things have like enormous, switching costs. I mean, if you've ever sold a house, you know how much that costs and buying a new one. With stocks, you know, that there's commission. Also, they're not fungible, right? Like, you know, a corner house is very different than even the house next door. Sure. One stock is very different than another. You know, and the third one is gold. And that's been sort of a store of value for a long time, but there's also lots of paper gold. And this is because all of the gold is in the same place. So there's only like four or five vaults in the world, for consumers at least, where you can buy gold. And what you're actually getting is sort of like a certificate that of the gold in there. And this is where they do something called fractional reserve lending. They'll lend out gold that doesn't exist in the vault. And this is something that they're allowed to do, amazingly enough. And there's a lot of sort of fake gold out there. So when you're buying like the gold ETF, it might not actually exist. You should always get the physical thing.
That's fascinating, yeah.
If you're getting the physical thing, well, then there's delivery costs and all this other stuff. And if it's in any substantial amount, you have to hire armed guards to actually bring it to your house and so on. So there aren't very good stores of value. And notice all of those things are really only used by rich people. Like if you're somebody poor, good luck trying to go and buy like a stock. You have to open an E-Trade account and you have to, you know, like answer all these like questions about whether you're a qualified investor and all this other stuff. And you have to, you know, have bank accounts associated with it. Like there's no way you're going to be able to buy it. And good luck buying a house, right? Like if you have bad credit, there's no way the bank's going to give you a mortgage, and good luck paying for it with cash, right? Like it gets very, very difficult for all of those things. Bitcoin is a superior store of value to all of those. And that's where it really shines, because in the market, there just aren't that many good stores of value. The nice thing about Bitcoin is that it's completely fungible. One Bitcoin is, you know, good, as good as any other Bitcoin. You can't really tell the difference. And it's accessible to everybody. You could be like a Silicon Valley insider. You're buying the same Bitcoin as a farmer in Bangladesh who's, you know, who wants to save their 20 bucks that he just earned and make sure that he's not getting diluted. And this is absolutely critical part of sort of societal infrastructure that we've lost over the past 50 years or so since the advent of fiat money starting in 1971.
That's such an incredible perspective, and I'm sorry to cut you short here, because again, we're learning so much just by talking with you. But thinking of it less as necessarily a currency that you're trading every day, and thinking of it more as a store of value, that makes a lot of sense there as well. We are running low on time here, so I just want to give you an opportunity to where can people find you, tell them about your book, and just kind of, you've got about a minute to say whatever you'd like, Jimmy.
All right. I'm on Twitter at Jimmy Song. I have a weekly newsletter, jimmysong.substack.com. I have three books that I've written. One is for programmers, Programming Bitcoin, that was published by O'Reilly. I have a second book that's sort of like a layman's introduction to Bitcoin, the Little Bitcoin book. And then I have a third book, Thank God for Bitcoin. That one is a moral argument for Bitcoin from a Christian perspective. They're all available on Amazon. All of them are also available on Kindle, physical book. Little Bitcoin book is also available in audiobook, Spanish and Portuguese. And I believe you can find Chinese online and several other languages. So hopefully that helps.
All right. Sounds great. You're readily available. Well, thank you so much again for giving us that perspective and teaching us so much this week. So happy to have you this week.
Thank you for having me.